what would it take to win? What it would take to win on climate change is to bring down the oil lobby and take the wealth that is in the hands of the top corporations and bring it into democratic public ownership of workers and community, and decide that we're going to use these resources not to dig up the tar sands, but instead to build real renewable energy resources. And you're not going to be able to do that unless you build mass resistance. And the obstacle to building mass resistance is not that we have to endlessly share facts, but really share a strategy to fight back. What we can do and what will work is if we take a message of a potential victory, a empowering message that not only is it important for you to join the struggle, but that we have a strategy to win. That's what's missing for most people.
That's Kashama Sawant, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Kashama Sawant on what it takes to win. In times of despair and distress, there may be the temptation to succumb to apathy and cynicism. You know, what's the use, who cares, etc. That shouldn't be your response. Finding kindred spirits and allies and working on issues important to you, such as the environment, war and peace, health care, affordable housing, racism, misogyny, homophobia, education, or just getting your town to put in a stop sign at a dangerous intersection. Sure, there are tedious meetings that go on too long and people who enjoy hearing themselves speak, but you work through that, and in the end, you feel so much better about collaborating with others to achieve positive goals. It's much better than getting bogged down in internal disputes, factionalism, and mutual recrimination. That's a formula for getting burned out. What does it take to win? To talk about that is Kashama Sawant. She's a member of the Socialist Alternative and was elected to the Seattle City Council in 2013. She is the first socialist to win a citywide election in Seattle since 1916. She was re-elected in 2015. She spoke at the University of Washington in Seattle as part of a day-long teach-in on activism, social justice, and health care organized by the People's Health Movement and Health Alliance International. And now, Kashama Sawant.
Thank you, sisters and brothers, for including me in a very important program of discussions around the international fight against the privatization and commercialization of healthcare. And whatever time I have with you all, I want to be able to spend talking about how we can craft strategies to build that struggle. But I wanted to start by acknowledging that this is indeed an international question, and as a matter of fact, I am hard-pressed to identify any social, economic, racial justice question that is not international. And I think it's framing it as an international question is really important. I'm an immigrant from India, and I grew up in a working-class neighborhood in what used to be the suburbs of Mumbai, but now Mumbai is such a sprawl. It's all now one big sprawling city. And I have a distinct memory of the mobile clinics that came there. And we used to get our checkups there as kids, our booster vaccinations. And it used to be a matter of pride. You know, I remember my mom saying, you know, you have to, you know, be showered, clean clothes, because, you got to show respect to the nurses who are going to be examining, you know, like it was a very respectful and respectable profession. There was an acknowledgement that this was a public and social component of our lives. And that aspect of socialization really touched every part of my life and my sister's life. And I mentioned this not to get personal, but more to talk about how certain basic needs are funded. It has very much to do with what opportunities people have later in life. I mean, I stand before you as a direct beneficiary of what I would call social democratic policies, meaning having, even though it was and still is, and globally this is a capitalist system, but within that capitalist system, having social democracy-based policies, meaning having policies that emphasize taxing the rich in order to make basic services available, My sister and I are direct beneficiaries of that. So our education was free, our healthcare was free, and we were able to flourish and come up to this point in our lives directly because of those advantages. My mom had a union, so on. So I think that that sort of goes to the whole question of why do we have the status quo that we have today? I think that if you look at poll after poll, and as a matter of fact, if you go back to the polls, even from the Truman era, you know, if you go to FAIR.org, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, you will see that even in this country, this so-called right-wing conservative country, I don't believe that it's right-wing and conservative, that's why I say so-called, but even in this country, polls that go back to the Truman era show that there is a wide majority that agrees that we need for healthcare to be publicly funded. And it all depends on how the question is framed. But I believe strongly that there is a broad agreement that the vision that people have for society is not what we have today. So the question really is not, I really would strongly argue, the question is not so much, oh my God, we have to question right, I mean, we have to convince right-wing America. No, the question is, why, given that there is broad agreement among hundreds of millions, indeed billions of people in this world, that the society, global society, needs to be structured differently, why is it that the status quo of inequality and injustice, lack of access to basic services, why does that persist? It is not because people don't agree. Broad swaths of humanity who are living in dire poverty are not arguing to live in dire poverty. They live in poverty because they have no choices, and they would much rather have a better standard of life and a raised quality of life. The question is, why are they not getting it? What's the barrier? And so that's where I feel like I can bring some insights that we can discuss and debate. But I wanted to focus my initial contribution on the United States because I think that's a very important example, not only because of the weight that the United States has in global capitalism, this is the seat of global capitalism, the United States, but also at this moment when Trump has been elected, you can't really discuss global politics without putting U.S. at the center. And I think that there are actually advantages to that. That, in my mind, as an activist and a socialist, that implies that the working people, the working class of the United States, people who are driven towards social justice, we have a key role to play because we have a key advantage. That if we make certain things happen, it will be a real source of encouragement to people everywhere. That is why the election of a socialist to a city council, I mean, it's not a big, in reality, it's not a big thing. It's not like we got elected to the White House. But the fact that we got elected to the city council as an open socialist, you know, speaking out clearly against the Democratic Party, refusing to take corporate money, everything that we did, was met with by laughter by the political commentators who had written our obituaries long before our campaign succeeded. But the point is that after we won, it not only made news in the United States, it made worldwide news. But the reason is that when we fight for something in the United States, it has a huge impact. It has a larger-than-life impact. That also, in my mind, translates into the idea that we also have a greater responsibility on our shoulders. So as activists, we have a greater responsibility. All right, I won't start with single-payer healthcare, but just with what happened recently. As we all know, ordinary working people all around the country joined together. We all joined together in celebrating Donald Trump and Paul Ryan's utter defeat and failure to pass Trump Care. And for years, the Republican Party politicians campaigned on the promise of repealing the ACA, and we as working people have fought consistently against these attacks. We have said very clearly that the gains that we obtained from the ACA, although they don't go far enough, have to be protected, they have to be defended, and we have been outspoken. Working people throughout America have been outspoken. But the reality is that the ACA, or Obamacare, also, and this is where, you know, just the analysis of the situation comes in, also already provides big insurance companies, big pharma, healthcare providers, still with too much power. The power to set impossibly high premiums, grossly overcharge for services, and to jack up pharma costs. And that is why, without a clear plan, it left Republicans painting themselves into a corner. because they had opposition both from both working people and from the right, from the Freedom Caucus, because they couldn't just kill Obamacare. They couldn't find a market-based alternative that would both increase profits for insurance companies while still providing affordable coverage to consumers. And their plan was so ramshackle that it divided instead of uniting their own 1% billionaire class. But despite all this, what was the fundamental reason that Trump was defeated? It was ultimately because working people fought back. The reality is that Trump, Ryan, and all the Republican elite, they apparently took a calculated risk that in this political system, under capitalism, under its oppressive conditions, that the poor people who would have been affected the most had the ACA been repealed, they gambled that those poor, the most oppressed people would be the ones that won't speak out because they're also the ones who don't regularly vote. So Trump and Ryan thought that they could get away with it. This proved to be a gross political miscalculation on their part, on the part of Trump and on the part of Republicans. The overwhelming majority of America, including a majority of Republican voters, strongly opposed TrumpCare. I hope you are all, as I was, warmed at the sight of thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people at the town halls, you know, just absolutely in revolt against their Republican Congress members and demanding an answer as to what they were going to do. If they were going to take away their health care, what were they going to replace it with? And a poll taken just days ahead of the debacle that the Republicans suffered showed that Trump care had only 17% support, because the promise was that they would repeal Obamacare with something better. Well, what's something better? There is no something better unless you have single payer health care. So when the polls asked, do you support repealing it without a replacement that is equal or better, 17% of people said that they support it. And polls that were done just with Republican voters also said that the majority were against it. And people clearly spoke out against the prospect of losing what they had gained. And the revolts in the Republican town halls grew to such a crescendo that the Congress members started hiding out. They were absconding. They were refusing to go to their town halls. They were in hiding because they didn't want to face the angry electorate. I do think, though, that while this defeat to Trump is a major victory for us, we must be clear that this won't be the end of the fight, and that is why I think it's important that we are gathered here. On the one hand, Republicans are guaranteed to continue their efforts to attack and erode health care, pass regressive tax reforms. They will go after reproductive rights, and, you know, what we should discuss what is the analysis for us now that they have used the so-called nuclear option and got Gorsuch confirmed. They will attack funding for women's and trans healthcare providers like Planned Parenthood. Socialist Alternative had internally in our discussions predicted that if Trump suffers a debacle on healthcare, it is very likely that he will start saber-rattling on an international issue as a distraction. It's so formulaic, you know. We've been here so many times in the past, and just as we predicted, now you have missiles landing on Syria. And I want to come back to that just briefly because it is part of our discussion for a strategy for a fight back. So we know that Trump is not done, and we will need to keep fighting. But on the other hand, we also all know that the Affordable Care Act is not enough. I believe, and I hope you all agree with me, we need to tax the rich and deliver Medicare for all single-payer health care throughout the nation. And we need to seize the opportunity right now. I think the time is ripe. Because Trump and the Republicans right now face a major crisis in their party. Future efforts to force through right-wing, anti-women, anti-immigrant, and anti-worker laws will be imperiled by the divisions within themselves that have been exposed and deepened by the battle for healthcare. I think part of our strategy, part of the strategy for social movements is to recognize accurately both the strengths and weaknesses of the opposition. So it is important that we recognize that the Republican Party comes out of this bruised and weakened and exposed for its very fundamental issues. It's not like something ephemeral that will go away. It exposes long-standing cracks in the Republican Party. It exposes it for the house of cards that it is. However, we also have to be sober, on the other hand, because while these divisions within the Republican Party have been highlighted, and particularly through the resistance of the far-right Freedom Caucus, which raised a finger to Trump, we do not have the luxury of lulling ourselves in our movement into complacency. We do have to recognize that this moment, it was not simply about defending the ACA. We will only, actually, it's an irony, we will only be able to actually defend the ACA if we fight for something much bigger than the ACA. And I think that at this moment, we are well poised, strategically speaking, to fight for and win single-payer healthcare. There's a whole new layer of millennials that has been energized, not just by the defeat of Trump on healthcare, but just overall. I mean, it's not that Trump has created this moment where people are going into revolt. What's happened is that Trump got elected at a moment where globally the millennial generation was already moving into revolt. You know, the Occupy movement happened. The Occupy movement itself was inspired by the Arab Spring, and now you have even bourgeois economists, you know, capitalist economists. I'm an economist, but I'm not a bourgeois economist. they recognize that we are probably heading into a second Arab Spring because the younger generations are really, you know, gearing up for a real fight. So this is the moment to look to win concrete victories. But the defeat of Trump has also energized physician groups, nurses unions, the AARP, the socialist left, and all of these groups have been long advocating for single-payer healthcare. But something more has happened even beyond that, right? The resistance has also brought out a broad layer of working class people, people who would never, we would never, at least I, in my 8 years of activism, have never seen them politicized, energized in any way, are now really eager to figure out how they can play a role in this movement, how we could actually win victories. And it is going even beyond that. It's actually also a period where we should be thinking about how to win over even some of Trump's supporters. How many of you here saw Bernie Sanders' town hall at McDowell County, West Virginia? I'm so glad that some hands are going up. You know, it was titled Bernie Sanders in Trump Country. I would really urge everybody to watch it. It's like a sort of a crash course in how consciousness can shift despite all odds, because these are white people, white, poor white people, low-income white people from coal mining country that most of us tend to ignore because we feel that they have, you know, because we correctly want to fight against racism, sexism, homophobia, which we should absolutely be unrelenting on. But from a standpoint of a strategy for the movement, we have to recognize that many of these people will be won over if you reach out to them on the basis of what they are suffering from. So it is incredible to see the shift in people's thinking. You know, here's Bernie Sanders, this guy from Vermont, who starts talking about poverty and single-payer healthcare and saying in no uncertain terms that it's not that we suffer from lack of wealth or resources in our country. The problem is that those resources are in the hands of a few, and those resources are not spent to raise our standards of living and deliver basic needs. So it's really a good reminder for us that there is the potential, without overstating it and without compromising on our stance on oppression. It is important that we can see that we can win working people over into a broad working class agenda with a program of demands that raises the quality of life for all. And the process of millions of working people who voted for Trump, who are realizing that the promises of this, you know, quote-unquote, draining the swamp, that these promises are systematically being betrayed, That process has begun. We are not going to see results from it immediately, but we have to understand that it has begun, and that, you know, it is in this context that we have to build our fight back. We need to build a real unity amongst our forces in a very principled manner around the demands that we all agree on. And we know that there is a shift taking place around single-payer healthcare. We should build a broad and strong movement around single-payer healthcare. And in order to seriously build this movement, we also have to be fully serious in our analysis. And what I mean by that is that we're not going to succeed if we do not recognize the primary obstacle that our movement faces, and this primary obstacle has to be overcome immediately. And that is that our reliance, whether conscious or otherwise, on the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is firmly wed to donations from big pharma and big insurance. And if we are to have success, we cannot be wed to the Democratic Party. Democrats have refused to bring Medicare for All or any single-payer proposal forward during the 2 years that they controlled the White House, Senate, and House of Representatives. Even at that time, the most progressive wing of the party refused to bring all its forces to bear, you know, refused to build a movement that could fight for a single-payer healthcare proposal, even though there was huge support for it. I mean, I mentioned this not in abstract terms. In Seattle, you know, everybody talks about, even this morning I was in an action in solidarity with somebody who's probably going to get deported soon, and we have to build a movement against that, against ICE raids and deportations. But I met somebody from outside Seattle who said, oh, I just love Seattle. Everything is happening in Seattle. And throughout the conversation, you know, when we started talking about why are these things happening in Seattle, it's not because Seattle is progressive. Yes, Seattle is progressive, but so are people in a lot of cities. The reason Seattle has had successes around, for example, $15 an hour, is because we built a movement that recognized that the politicians on the city council, most of them, were all Democrats. I'm the only socialist. They're all Democrats, and the mayor, that they're not on our side in an organic way. They will say that they're on our side, but what we do win will ultimately depend on whether or not we build an independent movement that does not allow itself to be beholden to what's acceptable to corporate politicians. So at first, most of the politicians were saying, well, of course I support people being raised out of poverty, but I don't know if we can get it right now. I don't know if 15 is the right number. I don't know if businesses will agree. I'll have to talk to businesses. We didn't do that. We instead built the 15 Now campaign, which brought in the strength of workers, and ultimately that was what was able to win $15 an hour. So my point is that we cannot allow ourselves to be deceived by the idea that, well, people, there are Democratic politicians who are speaking on our side. But in reality, who's actually fighting for it? They could fight for it if they wanted to. They could. They could have stopped Betsy DeVos's nomination if they had said, we're going to build a movement in every public school across America. We're going to shut down schools in a peaceful demonstration because we don't want this person who is completely hostile to the very idea, the very concept of public education. Those are the strategies that need to be used. But if politicians refuse to use that strategy, it is up to us to build that movement, and we cannot till eternity keep relying on them. What happened in early January? 13 Democrats in Congress voted against Bernie Sanders' proposal to allow Americans to buy cheaper medications from Canada and other countries, and they helped to kill the amendment. We shouldn't be surprised if Democratic representatives aren't willing to threaten billions of dollars in profit for the CEOs for the sake of our health. If we showed up to these town halls with 200, 500, 2,000, 5,000 people, just absolutely unrelenting in our demands for single-payer healthcare, as a start, it would start shifting the debate, I guarantee you. So my question really is, if Democrats support healthcare for all, what is stopping them right now from moving forward in states that they control? There is a movement in California that is fighting for single-payer health care. Why is California's Democratic Governor Jerry Brown speaking out against that movement rather than championing it? He recently said, "Where do you get the extra money? That's the question. Why know where you can get the extra money? Tax the rich. Tax Wall Street. Tax the billionaire class. That's how you, quote-unquote, create the money that was lost to us in the first place." Washington's Governor Jay Inslee said that he's anti-Trump, and I, of course, genuinely welcome the statements by Democratic politicians against Trump. That's very important. We need to stand together on that. But then Inslee said, "The House is on fire," you know, referring to Trump being in the White House. And then he said, "The House is on fire. We've got to put out the fire rather than engaging in the what ifs." What he means is that, you know, we need to defend what we have now and not expand the conversation for larger things because, wait, our house is on fire and we need to protect that. I understand the logic of that, but I don't agree with that logic. In our view as socialists and from our study of history, the best defense is a good offense. Right now, people are energized by the defeat of Republicans. Right now, we have to start fighting for single-payer health care. Imagine if California, Oregon, and Washington, all three states, won a West Coast-wide single-payer health care system by taxing big businesses and the super wealthy. I think this is winnable, but only if we build movements that refuse to be beholden to what's acceptable to corporate politicians. And if it's a public plan that actually delivers health care to everybody by virtue of being a human being, then it's a good plan. And if, just tactically speaking, if it works out better that all three states have the same plan, then we should do that. If it works out tactically more easily that there are some variations, but each state does it its own way, that's also fine. I think the more fundamental point I would stress more than the exact details, although the details are, of course, important, but my point is that at this stage, the debate is not about the details. At this stage, the question is, do we have the forces on our side to push for this? And so we have to build a real mass campaign on the ground for single-payer healthcare, and my contention is that we can do that even while we are figuring out the details, that we don't have to wait till those details are figured out. And in my experience, in real-life struggle, like the $15 struggle, like all the tenant rights that we've won, and like the marriage equality struggle that we were part of earlier, in my experience, though some of those questions will get answered or resolved as in the course of the struggle, that you can't have like a ready package. It's good to have a plan, but sometimes those details can change. And in my view, that's okay. What's important is that we win single-payer healthcare in all three states. And I have no doubt that if we did, first of all, I have no doubt that we can win if we build a sustained resistance. And secondly, I have no doubt that if we actually succeeded, that would have earth-shattering impacts. I mean, 15 would pale in comparison to the social, the political impact of people across America being energized. And this will be the biggest statement from working people saying we're now no longer relying on either political party, because even though there are legitimate differences between you two parties, neither of you has actually stood up for working people. You are both parties of Wall Street. And that while we want to be united with everybody against Trump, we also have to be clear that we're fighting for something larger. We have to build a movement on affirmative demands. You know, you can't energize a movement endlessly by saying, "Look at Trump, he's so awful." Of course he's awful, but we need to go beyond that. How are you going to fight him? The best way to fight him, the best way to give him an FU, is to win something that is completely antithetical to everything that he represents. And my point about the Democratic Party is not, absolutely not, that we should alienate ourselves from people who call themselves Democrats. Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, we would not have won. I mean, in our first election, we got nearly 95,000 Seattleites to vote for us. We have no illusion that a majority of those 95,000 are socialists. No, of course not. Most of the people who voted for us are Democrats. The point is to build unity in action on the basis of concrete demands that everybody agrees on. And when we built our campaigns, not only for election and re-election, but also for 15, the Democratic Party supporters who joined our struggle joined it because they believed that it was very much in accordance with their own values. And that is what we want to do. We want to really battle for winning over working people, regular people, to a program of demands that everybody agrees on. So the question, you know, it's a question of the sequence of logic. You know, the question should not be posed, okay, now we have to go to the Democratic Party and then see what they will agree with. No, instead, what we start with a completely different, a 180 degree different standpoint. We start with saying, what are working people willing to fight for? What can we build a movement for? And then if we can build a unity based on, say, single-payer healthcare, then we should ask the question, what would it take to win single-payer healthcare?
You're listening to Kashama Sawant on What It Takes to Win. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
What it would take to win is not alienating ourselves from people who call themselves Democrats, or indeed even Democratic politicians. But what it takes is to decide that the movement needs to fight. And so if Democrats are willing to fight with us, then that's brilliant if they're willing to do that. We welcome, and I as a socialist welcome, every Democratic politician who is willing to fight with us and not be beholden to corporate politicians. That is why last year, Socialist Alternative and I, we supported Bernie Sanders' campaign, and we built a movement for Bernie that is still going strong. And now people are asking the questions, you know, what's next? How do we build this movement? The story of how Canadian workers won their single payer is also useful to us in America. Canadian workers had long fought for their right to health care, but only succeeded when the workers, the labor movement, the socialist movement in Saskatchewan built a party independent of big business. It was called the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, or CCF, and it described itself as socialist. In 1946, the CCF passed public healthcare programs in Saskatchewan. And what do you think happened next in Canada? That program was so successful, for the simple reason that public healthcare succeeds, everybody in Canada wanted it. There was a clamor for it. And the response from working people was so great that in 1961, the federal government, which was the ruling parties, not the socialist parties, the ruling parties were forced to pass single payer federally because the movement was so strong, they knew that if they did not pass it, the workers' parties would come to power in the next election. That is the type of bold approach, I think, sisters and brothers, that we need in the coming months and years to lay the basis for real national healthcare reform that would be, as we all know, and many of you are healthcare professionals, a transition from a system designed for corporations, for wealthy executives, to one that is rooted in the interests of working people, in the interests of human beings, in the interests of our larger society. But to do this, we immediately need to unite our struggles in a principled way, understanding who's on our side and who's not. I think that all of us have to be there. Each and every one of us needs to be there, because it is through building mass campaigns and a sustained struggle that builds its strength on building the courage of working people, not on what's acceptable to people at the top. And I think that this is even more clear. The strategy that we need to use, I think, is even more clear with what's happening in connection with Syria. You know, The Trump administration has already launched missiles in Syria. And, you know, I think that whether we are talking about healthcare or, you know, the end to global warfare, we're not going to be able to do that unless we really build sustained pressure from the bottom. And there's a lot of other things we could do in order to build momentum. But I would also sort of step back a little bit and just to share a little bit about how we see movements developing. Sometimes, and actually often, movements develop in somewhat unpredictable fashion, meaning we may have been politicized and radicalized around, say, for example, the question of healthcare, but we have to be willing as activists to be able to fight on any issue that is coming up in the forefront just because of the forces of current conditions. Win that, understanding that whatever we win will be a sort of it will build the momentum for other things. So just to give you an example, some of the biggest social gains for the United States were the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency, which is now under direct threat, the Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision on abortion rights, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, which really made a huge difference to the most oppressed workers, for example, in the meatpacking industry and so on, and the end of the Vietnam War. All of this happened not in the reign of a Democrat. They happened when Richard Nixon was in the White House. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I've not really thought about comparing Trump to Nixon, but I think it's safe to say that Nixon was another right-wing, misogynist, racist, bigot, and thoroughly anti-worker and anti-union. These gains were won because the movements, first of all, at that time, made a very important calculation that we need to build ourselves independent of tying ourselves to the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party has failed us. That doesn't mean the Democrats shouldn't join us, but it has to be on terms of what our movement needs, not on the terms of what is necessary for XYZ Democrats' political career. That's the difference I'm making. So many of these movements reached a certain potential because they built themselves independently of that. And as a matter of fact, Richard Nixon was elected out of that. Now, we have to be careful and sober in how we analyze these things. That doesn't imply that it's great that Trump got elected. No, far from it. And it wasn't great because Nixon got elected. But the political process and the thinking and consciousness of working people is important. If a mass of people are at such a point that they are willing and able to fight for bigger gains, then it is important to do that and not use lesser evilism in election years, because it was precisely the rejection of lesser evilism that led Nixon to win, but it was also because of the rejection of lesser evilism that all these historic gains were won, none of which I think would have been won, at least in the same way, in the same speed as they were won, if movements had not built themselves, you know, mentally independent of the Democratic and Republican parties. That was one important calculation they made. A lot of the movements recognize that any one movement, like any one issue, whether it's anti-war, whether it's black freedom, whether it is women's reproductive rights, we are less able to win our own victories unless we join hands with other movements. So it was the coalescing of all these movements that led to all these gains in the same period. It was a huge period of gains, but they happened because the movements understood these things, and it was the coalescing of the movements that made it happen. So what I would say as an activist for single payer is that we should build for big actions and really defiant actions and, you know, get the press there, get some pressure, you know, have media reports generated out of our activism, out of our placards, out of our demands that shows that we are not just saying, oh, please, Senator Murray, please, Senator Cantwell. We're not saying that anymore. We are saying we want to fight for single-payer healthcare, and you have to come to this town hall and answer for why you voted against the amendment that Bernie Sanders had that would have made it cheaper for people to buy pharmaceuticals. That's just one example. I mean, they have a lot to answer for, but we could start there and then build that, but also knowing that if there is momentum around, say, immigrant rights, We have to throw ourselves into that struggle, because whatever victory we win on some other front will build momentum for the front we're fighting for. In my view, you know, because we live in a global capitalist system, there is no shortage of things that we need to change for the better, you know. So I honestly, you know, if you run the gamut of the misery that working people, billions of working people are subjected to, you know, from all the way from malnutrition of children to carnage in war and bombing, there is no shortage of issues. You pick any one and you win a victory, it's a step forward. It's a huge step forward. So I would urge everybody here to become part of the Trump-proof coalition to tax the rich in Seattle, because it's a concrete thing that we are fighting for. So what we are doing, which is most important, is the outward work, you know, building the resistance. And so one of the things the coalition is doing is building town halls with every council member, forcing council members to go to those town halls. I mean, I'm often asked by the media, you're so, you know, you just don't work with anyone. I mean, which is an absurd thing, because we're working with tens of thousands of people. But no, it's not true. We do talk to all the council members. The point is that we don't stay limited to that, and we don't tie ourselves, we don't confine ourselves to what they find acceptable. So if they don't support tax the rich right now, so be it. We will extract the yes votes by building the movement that's so strong that makes it politically impossible for council members, for politicians to vote no on it, because it comes with a real cost. And that cost can come only if we build sustained resistance, where we say that, look, if you vote no on such a straightforward thing, then you're going to pay a price for your own political career. And I don't think that we should, till eternity, have that logic. We have to actually fight to have our own representatives in office. But until we can do that, or while we are doing that, we also have to put pressure and demand accountability from all council members and say, you're going to tax the rich because this is what Seattle needs. Seattle is a growing city with incredible numbers of millionaires. And, you know, the greater Seattle area is now home to the world's two richest people, Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates. It's unconscionable that we have homeless people on the street. It's unconscionable that people don't have money to pay for rent, house, you know, education, healthcare, and so on. We absolutely need to do this. And maybe a lot of people found out because of the Trump Care debate that the ACA actually expanded Medicaid on the basis of having a progressive income tax built into it, which is a very important component. So that's a concrete example of the gains from Obamacare that we want to fight to defend. Same with, you know, extending coverage until the age of 26 in your parents' plan and so on. And the corporate media plays a disgraceful role in sharing information. And that's nothing new. It's endemic to capitalism, because the media, the police, all the other apparatus are controlled by it's not a conspiracy theory, it's just reality under capitalism. If you have a deep divide, if you have a deep political and wealth divide, and if most of the power and the wealth resides in the hands of a minority elite, then it is no surprise that the most of the apparatus that runs the economy, runs society, is primarily in their hands. So you know then you have to break out of that by having a Democracy Now or an Ed Mays or, you know, whatever other media sources, which obviously can't reach as many people as the corporate media do. As a matter of fact, if people haven't already, I would say it would be educational for everybody to read the New York Times on Syria. It's incredible. It's incredible how the language, you know, you have to pay attention to the language. It's so warmongering and hawk-like. This is the Trump administration that has been denounced by the New York Times. When it comes to bombing Syria, there's agreement. I mean, these are the things that we have to point out. But I would also say that we should overall, I think at this moment, it is a moment for optimism, in the sense that a lot of the recent examples have shown us that despite not having support from the social apparatus that is controlled by the super wealthy, people are not only getting educated, they are fighting back. They are starting to, you know, have what's most important here is not every fact, honestly, and I feel weird saying that because I'm a professor, I'm an economist. I take facts and analysis very seriously, but this is also an important aspect to point out about social struggle. It is not about having every fact at your disposal that makes you empowered. It's whether or not you feel you can win is what makes a change. So look at climate change. For example, the vast majority of the human population at this moment in history clearly understands the dangers of climate change and the need to move to renewable energy. You don't have to turn everyone into a climate scientist. I'm not a climate scientist. I couldn't tell you all the facts. But the point is, what would it take to win? What it would take to win on climate change is to bring down the oil lobby and take the wealth that is in the hands of the top corporations and bring it into democratic public ownership of workers and community and decide that we're going to use these resources not to dig up the tar sands, but instead to build real renewable energy resources. And you're not going to be able to do that unless you build mass resistance. And the obstacle to building mass resistance is not that we have to endlessly share facts, but really share a strategy to fight back. And I would say it's true, we need correct terminology. So for example, in the Tax the Rich, the Trump-proof coalition, one of the things that we have been insisting is that we should not call it an income tax. The last time there was a statewide campaign for taxing the rich, I don't know how many of you remember, it was in 2010. One of the reasons it failed was because the right wing made hay out of the language of income tax and went to the doors of working people in Eastern Washington and said that, well, they're going to come after your money next. You know how it is with taxes. Well, that seemed credible to them. But it's not that the absence of facts was the problem. It was the framing that was the problem. Instead, we would say, frame it as tax the rich. I guarantee you there will be majority support to tax the rich. There is no problem with taxing the rich. Everybody thinks it's high time that the rich were taxed and paid their fair share. So I would say that while we do face real obstacles in the form of media, in the form of not having information shared adequately, what we can do and what will work is if we take a message of a potential victory, you know, empowering message that not only are you important for you, not only is it important for you to join the struggle, but that we have a strategy to win. That's what's missing for most people. Then people will absolutely join this struggle. And in fact, a lot of the victories recently have shown that. I mean, look at the Muslim travel ban. Yes, it was the litigation effort that was done by the ACLU and others was critical, but that was not what put the backs of the Trump administration on the wall, against the wall. It was the airport demonstrations. It was the peaceful shutdown by people all the way from JFK to SeaTac. That was what put the administration on notice. The fear that, wow, in a moment's notice, tens of thousands of people will turn up. Ordinary people, these were not activists. I mean, we were there at the airport shutdown in SeaTac from start to finish, and most of the people who were there, we hadn't met before. These are not like regular seasoned activists. These were regular people who were about to go for a dinner and a movie or whatever and heard about it, found the idea of anybody being banned from the country stomach-turning, showed up, and shut it down. And it was like a mini lesson in civil disobedience, and it was incredible how thousands of people who had never seen each other before in their lives could build a campaign of several hours in a sustained manner, with discipline, with nonviolence. I mean, it was incredible. The only violence there was from the police departments of 7 different jurisdictions, including the Seattle police, keeping in mind that the mayor has declared this city as a sanctuary city. And he sent the police there, and we saw the police pepper spraying, arresting people, shoving their bikes on activists. But it's those real life experiences of fighting against the man and winning that builds a sense of empowerment. And that sense of empowerment is the main thing that we need to build for success. And the feeling that you can't win is the biggest barrier. And all the facts in the world will not help you build the movement, because it's the feeling that you can't win again in this David versus Goliath fight that keeps us down. And so what we can take is that message of empowerment. I and everybody else that is working with me in Socialist Alternative, we truly believe that we can create that caring, supportive society. That's socialism in our view. Socialism is a, if you don't want to call it socialism, that's fine, but I would say that we're in a new era now. There is no, it is not, this is not the Cold War era anymore. There is no, the S word is not the dirty word now. It's the C word. The new generations, if you look at the polls in America, this is the belly of the capitalist beast, but the newer generations in America are rejecting the status quo system that is offered to them and are really curious and open, curious about and open to different forms of societies. And what I mean by socialism is a global society that harnesses the incredible wealth of our world in order to deliver a high standard of living to all human beings in an environmentally sustainable way. I think that's a vision of a deeply supportive world. And also, we have to say it has to be done sustainably. Otherwise, you know, the ecological clock is ticking. So we have to have a strategy for a sustainable future. But we also have to have a strategy for a future that delivers high standards of living for everybody. We're not talking about, you know, going back to lower standards of living from decades past. We're talking about harnessing technology and science to make it better for everybody. The underlying vision and the ideas that we need to base our struggle on has to be that positive, affirmative, and supportive, and collaborative, and cooperative vision, because I do believe that human beings primarily want that. Human beings are collaborative by nature in our DNA. The system makes us competitive, you know, like it pits us against each other because we're all being forced to fight for crumbs. The underlying vision is a very positive and encompassing vision. I do think, though, that there's a distinction between offering that vision and encouraging people to fight for it and the strategies that we need to fight for it. So, yes, tax the rich sounds confrontational, but it is needed because working people are seething with anger at the fact that you have this incredible inequality in Seattle and nationwide at a time when the United States is the wealthiest country in the history of humanity, and we have 50,000 people dying every year simply because they don't have access to basic health care. We have food deserts right here in the wealthiest city. So, yes, the super rich will be angry with you. Bill Gates is not going to like it. But you know what? I don't care. And nor do most people. Because the people that I am fighting for and the people that we are together fighting for, they want that. Because what is mean-spirited, what is inhuman, what is really unacceptable is the status quo of inequality. There is nothing more mean-spirited than letting thousands of homeless people, you know, suffer this degrading existence while there is so much money in people's coffers and in Swiss banks and in offshore accounts. What is mean-spirited is having this system where millions of people have children that are dying of malnutrition or, you know, or other healthcare-related diseases. What is mean-spirited is this war that is going on in Syria and Yemen and just the total bloodshed that is happening everywhere. In my view, the two go together. The vision for a truly supportive and collaborative world and the strategy that will be needed to achieve it. And for the simple reason that if it were easy, if it was possible to have a transition to this world, this other world that we're talking about, by simply asking the rich people nicely, then we would do it. Honestly, there's so many other things I would much rather do than work 14-hour days to build our movement. And I don't say that as, you know, like you should thank me or anything. I'm not saying it in that way at all. My point is that why would we struggle if it weren't that we need to struggle? If all the billionaires in the world, all the executives of all the oil companies were to come together and say, you know what, we need a sustainable future. I agree with you. then we wouldn't need to struggle. The reason we need to struggle is that the interests of the capitalist class and the billionaire class are diametrically opposed to the interests of everybody else who wants a sane society. And so if we have to be contentious, then it's our moral and political duty to be contentious. And if they think it's mean-spirited, well, so be it.
That was Kashama Sawant on What It Takes to Win. She spoke at the University of Washington in Seattle. Kashama Sawant, a socialist, is a member of the Seattle City Council. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Vandana Shiva, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Angela Davis, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, Noam Chomsky, and Tariq Ali. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Julia Robinson of Health Alliance International in Seattle. Ed Mays recorded the program. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.